Maybe it shows I'm an old man and was born at the same, at a particular time, but I can't see those words and not hear that chorus repeat, 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 repeat through my head. This Bruce Springsteen's song from 1980, Everybody Has a Hungry Heart. In the 80s, I was in high school and then college, and AM radio, they would repeat this song again and again, and it has a really addictive hook. If you ever look at the lyrics, however, they're pretty somber. Got a wife and kid in Baltimore, went out for a ride, and I never went back. Like a river that don't know where it's flowing, I took a wrong turn and I just kept going. That's pretty sad. Abandoned his wife and family. Everybody's got a hungry heart. Everybody's got a hungry heart. Lay down your money and you play your part. Everybody's got a hungry heart. I met her in a Kingstown bar. We fell in love. I knew it had to end. We took what we had and we ripped it apart. Now here I am down in Kingstown again. Everybody's got a hungry heart. Everybody needs a place to rest. Everybody wants to have a home. Don't make no difference what nobody says. Ain't nobody like to be alone. The song just epitomizes this hungry heart. Springsteen actually wrote this for the Ramones, but when he wrote it, he liked it so much he decided to keep it to himself. And it became a major hit for him. And the line actually comes from a Tennyson poem entitled Ulysses, which is about Odysseus from that ancient Greek work, The Odyssey. And Tennyson begins his poem after the Odyssey, when Odysseus is back at home. And he's done all of that stuff through the Cyclops and the island. His wife, and he has to beat back all the suitors. And finally, when it's all said and done, he settles into normal life, which you would imagine should be restful and settled, what he was striving to get back with those great feats. And Tennyson ponders the hungry heart of Odysseus. Confronted again by domestic life, Ulysses, that's Odysseus in Latin, expresses his lack of contentment. His heart is still hungry, including his indifference towards the savage race whom he governs, his own people from Ithaca. Ulysses contrasts his present restlessness with his heroic past and contemplates his old age and eventual death. Life piled on life, were all too little, and of one to me, little remains and longs for further knowledge and experience. Everybody has a hungry heart. How many times do we hear this idea in popular music? You too. I just haven't found what I'm looking for. Mick Jagger, I can't get no satisfaction. Everybody has a hungry heart. We are restless. Now, the book of Ecclesiastes says that God has placed eternity in our hearts. And I always ponder that line, because eternity is the kind of thing that can't fit in a finite human heart. You can think of it as sort of an ache. And just watch people. People will come to me and they'll say, Pastor, I've got a problem. And you'll sit down and you'll listen and you'll pray for them. And maybe the prayer will be answered and the problem will be addressed. And it'll be a time of relief. Back to the next one. I've got another problem, Pastor. Oh, really? And another, and another, and another. And we just can't find rest. Humanity is endlessly restless. We live in the most broadly secure, comfortable, affluent society the world has ever seen. Yet people are dissatisfied, anxious, and suffering. If you check news feeds today, you will hear that American youth, the most prosperous, secure, blessed population the world has probably ever seen. That doesn't mean life is great for everyone, by no means. But comparatively speaking, if you span history, and what do we hear? They're anxious. They're depressed. Oh, and the irony is that often, the wealthier and more privileged their home, the more anxious and depressed they are. And this was remarkable to me when I worked in the Dominican Republic and worked with Haitians who would make maybe 50 cents a day, and their lives had none of the security and none of the affluence that we predictably enjoy. I never once heard of a suicide. Didn't see that much sort of privileged anxiety. They were anxious about very real things. Death was stalking them, and they struggled. But when death is not stalking us, we're chasing something else, never satisfied for long, even when we catch it. C.S. Lewis puts this well in Mere Christianity. The longings which arise in us when we first fall in love, or first think of some foreign country, or first take up some subject that excites us, are longings which no marriage, no travel, no learning can really satisfy. I'm not now speaking of what would be ordinarily called unsuccessful or unsuccessful holidays or learned careers. I am speaking of the best possible ones. There are something we grasp at in that first moment of longing, which just fades away into the reality. I think everyone knows what I mean. The wife may be a good wife, and the hotels and scenery may have been excellent, and chemistry may be a very interesting job, but something has evaded us, and we feel it. Everybody has a hungry heart. So we have this quest for a spiritual home. In May, I'm going to be doing a conference with a couple of friends, Jonathan Pajot and John Verveke, who will be doing it in Southern California. And this will be the theme of the conference. And it'll be interesting because people will be approaching it from all different angles. But in many ways, this is the story of the Bible. In Genesis, even in a perfect garden, the hearts of the man and woman were restless, and at the prompting of the serpent, maybe God is holding out on us. Maybe there is more. Maybe the fruit is the answer. Abraham and the patriarchs wanted a home, a land of rest, and they didn't get there. The children of Israel wind up in captivity in Egypt, and they long for freedom even after forgetting God's name. God delivers themselves bound by all sorts of other things. Even Moses, the hero of the story, who God sees face to face, doesn't get into the promised land. In Joshua and Judges, the people finally, the next generation in fact, finally arrive at the promised land. And guess what? They're not satisfied. They don't finish the task of conquest. They get in bondage to all sorts of things and nations and people around them. In Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles, God finally raises up David, and Israel seems to achieve part of its promise, but David, after his conquest, of course, one day very famously looks out from his palace and sees his neighbor's wife and wants her and takes her and impregnates her and then covers it up with the murder of his most loyal servant, her husband. And God said, all that I gave you, wives, concubines, riches, conquest, all the success in the world wasn't enough. you needed to take your neighbor's wife and kill your friend to cover it up. Everybody has a hungry heart. This is our condition. Even as a man after God's own heart, he is a flawed king, a flawed father, disqualified from building God's house of rest. And then the prophets come, and Israel is taken into exile, and they long for the promised land, but just a remnant goes back, and they resettle, but it never meets expectations. And when we get to the Gospels, there's Israel in the promised land still. Now they had been subjugated by the Persians, by the Greeks, and then the Romans are there, and they're fighting with each other. The dream of a land of rest has still eluded them. On Good Friday, we talked about the apocalypse of Israel's hidden king. Palm Sunday, he's welcomed into Jerusalem. Hosanna, son of David. Good Friday, crucify him, crucify him. He saved others. He cannot save himself. Jesus raised expectations that Israel's God might now finally finish the job, but Jesus seemed difficult to understand. He had so much promise. There was mercy and strength. There was power and kindness. But he just didn't follow the script. He certainly got the attention of tens of thousands of people. Why didn't he train them? Why didn't he arm them? Why wasn't he a deliverer like David, who could wield the sword and kick out the Romans like David kicked out the Philistines? Jesus just didn't seem to have the right idea. And then he goes to Jerusalem, is arrested and executed, which is how all supposed messiahs seem to die. As evening approached that Good Friday, Joseph of Arimathea, a rich man who had himself become a secret disciple of Jesus, going to Pilate, unveiled himself, and he asked for Jesus' body. And Pilate ordered that it be given to him. And Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out of the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. The next day, the one after the preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. "Sir," they said, "we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days I will rise again.' So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise his disciples may come and steal the body and tell people that he had been raised from the dead." What deceit? Would that really be a win for them? "His last deception will be worse than the first. Take the guard," Pilate answered. "Go make the tomb as secure as you know how." So he went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting the guard. After the Sabbath, at dawn on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven. Now, if you remember Good Friday, there's a lot of directionality in the apocalypse. There was darkness in the sky. The curtain of the temple is ripped, not from bottom to top, but from top to bottom. The temple is the connection between heaven and earth for the Jewish nation. It is God's embassy, God's house on the earth, mirroring the temple in heaven. You can read about that in the book of Revelation. Now an angel comes down from heaven, and the earth shakes. And going to the tomb, the angel rolled back the stone and sat on it. And you can imagine the guards, who at that point were probably sort of drowsily sitting there, in absolute utter shock. What are they supposed to do? An angel comes from heaven, shining like the sun, effortlessly rolls back a massive stone, sits on it, probably crosses his arms and looks at the guards like, what are you going to do? They're not going to do anything. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were as white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. Just picture the scene. Now, what's interesting is, unlike Gospels written centuries later that had other different agendas, none of which were eventually accepted by the church, they'd have much more embroidered stories happening of Jesus coming out of the tomb, followed by a huge cross with a mouth on it, all sorts of wild ideas. Nothing like that. Just this. The angels, who were probably just as scared as the guards, do not be afraid. And I always find a note of irony with this, because if an angel came out of heaven, shining like lightning, and came down right here, it'd be like, if you don't want us to be afraid, you're going to have to turn down the wattage a little bit, maybe sneak up on us like other angels in the Bible. But if you're going to come in like this, yeah, we're going to be terrified. So the angel says, do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus, who was crucified. He is not here. He has been raised, just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples, he has been raised from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Now I have told you. Wow. So the women hurried away from the tomb. At least in Matthew's account, they don't even bother getting near him. I can imagine running away is the only direction you would want to go. So they hurry away from the tomb, afraid, yet filled with joy. They don't quite know how to feel. Suddenly, Jesus met them. Greetings, he said to them. And they came to him. Now notice, the angel looks like lightning, is shining like the sun, is terrifying that they run away, but Jesus is not. And he welcomes them. And they came to him and clasped his feet and worshiped him. Then Jesus said to them, do not be afraid. The angel said to them, do not be afraid. Jesus says to them, do not be afraid. It's almost always the first word out. Do not be afraid. Go tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me. Now, N.T. Wright has made the observation that these stories are remarkably unembroidered or unadorned. And you'll find some other interesting details, and you can look at Luke and you can look at John, and often we like to sort of put them all out and try to get all the pieces together, but the point of all of these stories is that these are eyewitness accounts, and there's no sort of getting the story straight by putting all of the pieces together. A few centuries later, books would be written to try to do that, but the church left all four Gospels as is, because the Gospels are eyewitness testimonies. And just like as regularly happens, I'm sitting in my office working, and I hear tires squealing and a crash here on Florin Road. A lot of accidents on this corner. I get up out of my chair. I go outside to see, you know, do I need to call an ambulance? Is everyone okay? And then you sit, you start talking to people, some of which have been hanging around. What happened? There's always, on one hand, everybody knew an accident happened. Sort of the basic framework is there. But when you look at the details, a lot of the people saw things from different perspectives. Here in Matthew, there's the story, unembroidered. It's an eyewitness account of what happened, probably from one of those women. And if you've ever been in a situation of shock, you know how the brain works. But it's very important to be clear, C.S. Lewis continues on this, about what these people meant here by resurrection. When modern writers talk of the resurrection, they usually mean one particular moment, the discovery of the empty tomb and the appearance of Jesus a few yards away from it. That's what we read about. The story of that moment is what Christian apologists now chiefly try to support. Almost exclusive concentration on the first 5 minutes or so of the resurrection would have astonished the earliest Christian teachers. In claiming to have seen the resurrection, they were not necessarily claiming to have seen that. Notice in Matthew's account, the women don't see Jesus walking out of the tomb. In claiming to have seen the resurrection, they're not claiming to have seen that. Some of them had, some of them had not. It had no more importance than any of the other appearances of the risen Jesus, apart from the poetic and dramatic importance which the beginning of things always have. What they were claiming was that they had all, at one time or another, met Jesus during the 6 or 7 weeks that followed his death. In other words, the takeaway of this is Jesus is alive. And they met him at one point or another. This Jesus that they saw crucified is now alive. Something has changed in the fabric of the world. Sometimes they seem to have been alone when they did so, but on one occasion, 12 of them saw him together, at least 12. There are probably more in that upper room. And on another occasion, about 500 of them. St. Paul says that the majority of the 500 were still alive when he wrote the first letter to the Corinthians about 55 AD. In other words, if you were alive at that moment, you could go amongst the Christian community and bump into dozens of people that had seen the resurrected Lord. And that reality begins to infiltrate the consciousness of that community, and it spreads something and changes something in the world. Suddenly, our hungry hearts have a little bit more of a direction in terms of our quest for a spiritual home. Now, some people are skeptical about whether or not it happened, and you go to YouTube and find endless debates about it. Others might say, well, strange things happen. What does that have to do with me? I hear that sometimes from people. Everyone still seems, however, to have a hungry heart. And the question is there any answer to humanity's hungry heart? Lewis leans into this when he notes that we were always looking for something in romantic love that even the best lover was not able to satisfy. We're often looking for something in a good meal or a good vacation or a good job that even the best meal or the best vacation or the best job doesn't seem to satisfy. In other words, we seem to be built for a world other and better than this one. The New Testament writers speak as if Christ's achievement in rising from the dead was the first event of its kind in the whole history of the universe. You saw that first fruits reference in one of the hymns we sang this morning. He is the first fruits, the pioneer of life. He has forced open a door that has been locked since the death of the first man. He has met, fought, and beaten the king of death. Everything is different because he has done so. This is the beginning of the new creation, a new chapter in cosmic history has opened. And we say, yeah, but people still die. We still named names this morning. But this transformation has begun in history, which is impossible to deny. A powerful transformation has been working its way through history. Disciples of this Jesus began to live in a new way. And because of Jesus' resurrection and his promise of participation in it, they, with fits and starts, they're flawed like all of us are, start to practice Jesus' way of living. And it began to transform the world. Not all of a sudden, not perfectly, still not perfectly, but it's still moving. And it's fueled by hope of the next. So profound, Tom Holland, and you say, well, Pastor, why do you always use that book cover? Well, number one, it has a nice, has that nice picture of the crucified Christ. But the point of the book is exactly the point I just made, and made by a man who, when he started writing the book, was skeptical of the whole thing. But when he finished the book, Tom is still sort of on the edge, finished the book, said, you cannot deny that the crucifixion and resurrection of Jesus fundamentally changed world history for the better. And even the most ardent atheists and use the morality of Christ often even to argue against the church and Christians, saying, you Christians aren't good enough. And to which the Christian should probably say, that's right, we're not. But our master is someone who was and is alive today. So profound has been the impact of Christianity on the development of Western civilization that it has come to be hidden from view. It's so profound, we can't see it. It is the incomplete revolutions which are remembered. The fate of those which triumph is taken for granted. This has been the result of Jesus' resurrection. Jesus at once heightens our hunger, and this we see through history, through civilizations. Our hunger is heightened each time we actually achieve something which is good. You won't know you are hungering for a better relationship until you've had a good one. You won't know you're hungering for a better meal until you've had an excellent one. And at that point, up it goes again. That hungry heart is a sign that we are made for something better. And it whispers to us, we will get there. It makes us less satisfied with the junk food that bloats and weakens us now and makes us hunger for him. Augustine's greatest quote, our hearts are restless, Lord, it was actually a prayer, until it finds our rest in you. What Jesus does is offers a community to travel with. It's not always an easy community to travel with because it's supposed to be good, and sometimes we discover, the people still complain. They still hurt one another. They still sin against each other, but the bar has been raised. Home is never an individual thing. It's about a family. Don't make no difference what nobody says. Ain't nobody like to be alone. Springsteen was right. It's not something we quest for individually. It's something we quest for together. Jesus offers a way of life that is the shape of the cross, which seems opposite from what we hunger for. But there are things in us that must be put to death. life that offers a renewal from the inside out. Because there are dead places in us that must be healed. Jesus offers a path that goes through the grave into the life we were made for. Our hearts are still hungry, yes, but they're moving in a direction. The church is the place where people on this path pursue Jesus and learn to walk with him. We stumble, we fail each other, but our master is a determined master, so he doesn't give up on us easily. Listen to your hungry heart. The hunger in your heart is there for a reason. Eternity is yearning for something. Ask for better food than you will find in this world. Let's pray. Lord, our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you, and we won't actually find that level of rest until the promise of the resurrection is finally completed, until the first fruits have been followed by the rest of the harvest. Lord, and it can be burdensome. And it seems, Lord, that sometimes the older we get, the heavier the cross is that we must bear. But Lord, give us the strength and the inner transformation to understand that our quest for a spiritual home will be satisfied, and that the recurring admonition to not be afraid is here for us as well. May we not turn back, but may we continue to move towards you in the knowledge of your grace and the promise of your Spirit. Hear our prayer. In the name of Jesus, amen.